So I work for a Toronto-based provincial aid service organization called PASAN, which started in 1991 as a grassroots activist response to the HIV crisis in the provincial prison system and federal prison system. It started as a subcommittee of an AIDS activist group called AIDS Action Now in Toronto. It's grown and changed since then. It's now a nonprofit organization. We don't take funding from corrections. All of our funding comes from the government and some private foundations. It's all from healthcare, mostly HIV and Hep C prevention healthcare. So we do have to be somewhat careful, though, when we navigate how we do our work because we are a nonprofit. So depending on who our funder is, for example, the feds, words like advocacy and activism and harm reduction are not well received. We also have to be pretty strategic because most of our work is done inside correctional institutions. So we have to be pretty strategic about the individual, institutional, and systemic organizing and advocacy work that we do because we don't want to lose our clearance, because we do a lot of direct support inside with people who are incarcerated. So what we do is offer support and advocacy around HIV, hepatitis C, and harm reduction issues for people currently incarcerated and people in the release community. So we definitely work to ensure that people are receiving the health care to which they are entitled, especially people who are living with HIV and Hep C and co-infection in institutions in Ontario. And regardless of sero status, we will support a trans-identified prisoner no matter what, because of the myriad issues that someone who's trans-identified can experience when they're incarcerated. We also try to address health care issues as a human rights issue through improvements in health care, general prison conditions, policies, and management. So I was going to give the example. We are one of the four interveners in Stephen Simon's case, where he is bringing a lawsuit against the feds for lack of access to the tools to manage his own health care. So there is a law of equivalency in health care in federal, which means that people who are incarcerated in a federal institution have the right to the equivalent healthcare that they would receive in the general community. So for someone incarcerated in a provincial institution in Ontario, there is no legislation or law about equivalent healthcare. And for someone who hasn't been sentenced and isn't serving a sentence in a provincial institution in Ontario, they may actually get access to far fewer programs and healthcare services. Do people here have a sense of the difference between provincial and federal institutions? Does anyone want me to give a little brief rundown of what the differences are? Okay. So in Ontario, provincial institutions include jails, treatment centers, detention centers, and correctional institutions. You'll find people in there serving sentences for 2 years less a day, and people on remand. Remand means people who don't have bail, so they lack the economic or social capital to post bail. So they're awaiting trial and awaiting sentencing. You'll also find people who have been sentenced and are awaiting transfer to another institution, either federal or provincial. There's all provincial institutions less one are operated as maximum security institutions because people are awaiting sentencing. There is one institution that's medium security, and that's in Thunder Bay because there's also a jail there where people are held if they are seen as max. But only the men's side is also seen as max. So we also hear, and the provincial also includes lots of super jails. So the super jails are usually, there's one in Penetanguishene, one in Lindsay, one in Milton, just outside of here. And they're building one in Windsor right now, which is just a mini one, it's about 400 people. And outside of Toronto, they're building one that'll house 1,900 people. These are massive complexes, very much the Panopticon idea. The one in Maplehurst, most of the people are in remand. So any given day in Ontario, the people in remand outnumber the people serving sentences in provincial and federal combined. In federal institutions, the people that you will also find in provincial detention centers, you'll find people on immigration hold. There is a Canadian Border Services Agency detention center in North Toronto, but you will find people on immigration detention everywhere in the province. On average, people are in provincial detention for 2 to 3 months, but you will also find people in there who've been for over 2 to 3 years. So federal, you'll have people who have been sentenced to 2 years plus a day. It's operated by Corrections Services Canada. It's a federal institution, and it's operated by regional headquarters. The headquarters for Ontario is in Kingston. There are 12 current institutions in Ontario, but Kingston Penitentiary is on the way to being shut down. So, you know, you may recall Vic Tate, the public safety minister, saying that they're not building new institutions. However, they are building 2,700 more cells across the country, which is the equivalent of 7 more institutions. They're just building them onto existent institutions. So I just wanted to give you a brief overview of prison populations, and Chris has touched on some of that, and the health of imprisoned peoples. Time allows, I just wanted to touch a bit on perceptions, construction, and enforcement of gender inside prisons. And if time doesn't allow that, we can always do that in question period or another workshop. That's not a problem. And so I just want to be clear that I speak as an ally and as a support worker, and I'm not trying to condense or give you the view of everyone inside. Someone's narrative may be quite different. We've got 20 minutes. It's going to be a very unique voices that have been removed from our communities. So I apologize beforehand for any generalizations or omissions I may make. If you want to talk to me about it, bring it up in questions. Tell me after. I have my card. You can email me or call me about it. So I also wanted to say that there is one federal institution in Ontario for women. It's in Kitchener. It's called Grand Valley Institution. The majority of the other institutions that are federally operated are in Kingston or in the Kingston area. There's one in Gravenhurst as well. So Krista touched on this, and we just want to talk about who is inside our institutions. And so we're looking at mass incarceration of populations and mass incarceration of Native peoples due to policies of colonization, dispossession, systemic discrimination, and racism. We're looking at socioeconomic deprivation and resistance to these processes, and those resistances also being criminalized. And when I talk, and I bring up stats about numbers, I want to be very clear that I'm not doing this to perpetuate and enforce stereotypes of criminality. I'm just looking at it because I think it's important to look to give context about the structural and social issues that affect people who are locked up in prisons, and to illustrate how incarceration is one of the interlocking structural and social factors that can determine health status and health outcomes, especially for communities that experience mass incarceration. Because it's one node, it's a nexus point in a colonial relationship, and it's the criminal justice system. So it's a lot of things come together in that one point. So I just wanted to briefly mention that. So we're looking at people who are overclassified to higher security levels, especially women. Any woman who is incarcerated, women are overrepresented inside, and also overclassified in max security. Aboriginal women just inflate that number. Many Aboriginal women are spending life in prison in max, and that means they have fewer access to programs, especially to any spiritual or elders, any spiritual programs, and to elders and to any educational programs. More than 50% of federally sentenced women are sent to segregation more often, and they're paroled less often. And also there's relations there to HIV. So Aboriginal people comprise 25% of positive HIV test reports, and among women who tested positive for HIV, 45% were Aboriginal. So I think we need to look at incarceration and mass incarceration as a serious structural determinant of HIV vulnerability. And Howard Sapers is the correctional services, so he's the federal correctional investigator. He released a special report 2 weeks ago, and it was a special report because he thinks we're at crisis point now around mass incarceration of Indigenous peoples in this land, in their land. But, and about a year ago, or 2 years ago, he also released a report around African, Caribbean, and Black communities and the overrepresentation, disproportionate number of people from those communities being incarcerated, especially in Ontario. And also, if you looked at the front of the Toronto Star, the article around the disproportionate representation of young Black students and Indigenous students, that's also a product of Harris zero tolerance policies. So we may hear like school to prison pipeline when we often talk about American prison industrial complex, but it's an example of how there is a school to prison pipeline in a Canadian system. and that these zero tolerance policies kick people out of school without supports and without community supports. And often people are more at risk of incarceration over policing. We have communities that are over policed and overcharged and over sentenced. So, and there's not enough support. So we're also looking at people who have a history of institutionalization. That's residential schools, training schools, foster care, group homes, people with a long history of involvement in children's aid and Catholic children's aid, treatment centers and psychiatric institutions, people with mental health issues, whether that's diagnosed or undiagnosed or misdiagnosed. We're looking at people who are poor, people who are working class, people who are homeless, things that you and I, I'm making assumptions about this audience, but things that
university.
If you're, yeah, things that like after this ends, you might want to go have a drink, jerk off, smoke a joint. If you're homeless, you're going to get arrested for any of those things if you're going to do them outside. So there is an overrepresentation of people who are homeless or underhoused in prison. And also the factors that contribute to homelessness are the similar factors that contribute to incarceration, that contribute to health vulnerabilities. There's legacies of family violence. So many people that you meet inside have histories of early traumatic abuse and trauma, violence, parental neglect, lack of formal educational opportunities, educational and learning disabilities, acquired brain injuries. Systems have failed, and there has not been enough community support, and people get incarcerated. I was working inside last week at a correctional center and was running a program in the women's side, which I don't usually do. I do it very rarely because our women's worker was off. And a young woman, and according to the, like we were running the workshop and a young woman was being brought back from the hole, which is segregation, where you're locked up by yourself for 23 hours and 20 minutes a day, 40 minutes, sorry. You might get out for 20 minutes for a shower or to use the phone, but she was on suicide watch, so I doubt she got out. So when you're on suicide watch, you're only in there. You don't have any sheets. You just have the gown. She had, according to the woman there, we'd stopped the workshop and we talked about it because people were so upset. She was a cutter. And according to the woman there, like she was a nice girl, but just didn't belong there. She had serious mental health issues. And one of the staff gave her a razor. So they're like, all of us had to listen to what was going on. And they were all screaming. And so what staff did was just shut all the hatches. To get the, and what they were screaming was like, get the razor away from her. She needs help. She needs care. So instead of listening, all the hatches were shut because there's a steel door and a hatch underneath. Another staff intervened, took the razor, but then she was put in suicide watch, which means she's in segregation. That's not mental health support. That's further punishment and it's more punitive for someone undergoing a severe mental health crisis. And if you think people get admitted to healthcare inside, don't think that they're in a bed or a hospital. Healthcare is cells. You're just under nursing supervision. There are also cells in healthcare. You're not going to be out again. Okay. And also, I just wanted to mention that mandatory minimum sentences. We're having lots of people inside who use substances or who are involved in economies around drugs. So if we're going to be following the pattern of what happened in the States around mandatory minimum sentencing, and there was like a piece of good news that came out of the States recently where there was a drop in charges and representation of African-American women in New York State, that was because they've been repealing some of the mandatory minimum sentencing laws. When judicial discretion gets removed, a lot of the negotiation happens in the cop shop or in the prosecutorial office or the Crown. So if you don't have, and lots of times because of the hierarchy and gendered hierarchy around drug use and drug distribution and who has say and who has power, lots of people who are identify as female are often just runners and don't have enough information to trade to get charges dropped. So there is a huge, we're going to look at a huge increase in the number of poor women inside, and it can be poor women of color. I just want to talk about how tough on crime and war on gangs, guns and drugs, those policies and legislation attack communities and relationships, and how that attacks, those attacks leave people open to health vulnerabilities such as HIV risk and Hep C risk. So there's people, there are friends, there are family, there are chosen families, our neighbors, our lovers, our coworkers, our bosses, the person who sells you a coffee. They're the voices that are removed from our communities and the fabric of our communities. gets torn, we use relationships for support, emotional and financial and political support. And imprisonment strains these relationships and support networks. And communities, you can describe them in many ways, and they can be made up of many different things. But as a process, relationships and networks of support are a pretty big part of that process of community. When those relationships are broken, a lot of people no longer have any supports when they might really need them. For example, when exiting prison. So then they may end up in situations of survival that put them more at risk. That could be survival sex, using drugs, sharing supplies, doing things that they may not normally do that can put them at risk of actually reincarceration as well. So people don't surrender their human rights when they enter prison, including the right to access health services. So this is one thing we have to remember. We hear the cry from the right that, like, oh, you know, hug a thug, and like that person wants dental care, and that person, you know, wants to see a specialist. Of course, people have the right to see a specialist and have the right to dental care if they can't actually leave the institution to get a tooth pulled. So I think I'm just going to briefly talk about what it is like for a trans person entering a carceral environment. Trans people are usually imprisoned according to a gender assigned at birth. And unless they've had like something that's defined as like a permanent reassignment surgery, can be offered protective custody upon entry to an institution. Protective custody carries its own stigma because people who are in PC are seen as child molesters, rapists, rats, snitches, and people who owe other people money. So there's PC segregation, so people are just in a cell with one other person for 23 hours and 40 minutes a day. And then there's like an open range PC. But that also means that some people who are the most violent are put in with the most vulnerable. And I'm not saying trans people are all the most vulnerable. I meet a lot of really tough people. And it also can mean, depending on how much social capital you have outside, how you might survive inside. But also there's this thing. And also we see way more people who outwardly identify as trans women be incarcerated than people who outwardly identify as trans men incarcerated. That might just be an invisibility. We don't know yet. But there's also fewer people in women's institutions at this time. Trans people are often something called dry-celled upon entering an institution, which means they're put into a cell with no running water for days because there's this assumption that trans people will always smuggle drugs in order to survive inside. There's this gender performance inside, and it is a hyper-masculinity. It is so tough because prison is seen as an emasculating environment. There is so much domination of the state, and the COs act that out on you as well. And so there's a lot of attack of people who do not fit a hyper-masculine, and it's like act tough or look tough. And if you don't fit that model, you can easily become preyed upon. So if you're effeminate, if you can't fight for yourself, if you're seen as weak in any way, you could definitely be open to physical assault. There's a lot of homophobia. There's a lot of serophobia. A lot of the people we support who live with HIV go off their meds when they're inside or not out about HIV status inside because they are afraid of the consequences. We've definitely worked. I just worked with someone who just got out this week. But who was jumped and bounced from a range. He was beaten quite severely when people found out he was HIV positive because a guard dropped it. It's really hard to maintain your confidentiality inside. And in a women's prison, I would also say around gender enforcement, the whole project of women's institutions is around correcting deviant behavior. But that's also correcting deviant behavior. It's compounded when the state already sees certain bodies as deviant to begin with. So that's like Indigenous women and people of color and women of color already seen as deviant to begin with. So then there's the deviance of also being criminalized. And so a lot of the historically, a lot of the programs offered were seen as feminine, so cooking and cleaning and knitting, and there is still this idea in there of what is ladylike. I had a woman be threatened to be put in the hole when we were doing this workshop because she wasn't wearing a bra because she couldn't get one that fit, And it, because she wasn't wearing a bra, they were going to throw her in segregation and give her a misconduct. I mean, there is this idea of what is okay, and it's this assimilationist idea as well. So here's prison health. I actually didn't even mention the HIV and Hep C rates. I think you did.
No.
Okay. I will briefly mention that, and maybe you guys can think of a question. There's just so much. So 2007 study in federal was done by Correctional Services Canada. 31% of federal prisoners are Hep C positive. 4.6 are HIV positive of those tested. These numbers are of those tested. They're self-identifying by people inside. So that means that Hep C rates in federal are almost 40% higher than they are in the outside population. In provincial, there hasn't been a study done in provincial since 2002, and the report came out in 2003, if anyone wants to partner on that. So we were looking at prevalence rates in provincial of in between 11 to 20% of Hep C, and then about 2% of HIV in provincial. And so we're looking at HIV rates in provincial about 11 times higher and Hep C rates about 22 times higher in provincial than in the general population. So we're looking at really disproportionate ways that some severe infections can affect people at the same ways that there's like a intersection of vulnerabilities for incarceration and bloodborne illnesses, really. So that's it, my friends. I kind of went all over the place. I'm sorry.